They say that over 3,000 people have been killed by the drone strikes. They estimate 800 of them civilians, 175 of them children. But others question the figures and say that they have only been able to identify by name 170 of those killed, and that we should consider all of the rest of them innocent. And some of the Pakistanis we've talked to said they might be Taliban sympathizers, but that does not mean that they are engaged in militant activity, and particularly activity that's aimed at killing U.S. soldiers or aimed at killing people in the United States. The first strike of the Obama administration in Pakistan was a mistake. It hit a man who was a pro-government official that was part of a pro-peace committee, killed several members of his family as well as a local shopkeeper and two of the neighbors. This young man, who was severely injured, is the only one who was left alive after that drone strike. There's an example here of a compound that was destroyed on December 31st, 2009. And I have a chapter in the book that's dedicated to the victims, because I think it's so important that we humanize the victims. We don't see their pictures in our newspapers or on our TV screens. We don't hear their stories. As I said, all we hear is militants killed. So I want to read a little from the book about the tragedy that befell the family of Karim Khan. It says, "The drones didn't just hover overhead that evening of December 31st, 2009, watching the movement of the villagers below, as it had done on so many other occasions. No, this time it let loose a missile into the very heart of Karim Khan's family compound. When the chaos dissipated, Khan's brother and son had been blown to bits. News reports allege that the target of the drone had been Haji Omar, a Taliban commander, but the villagers insisted that Haji Omar had been nowhere near the village that night. The tragedy that forever scarred the lives of Karim Khan's family was the product of a mistake made by a faraway aggressor who had faced no punishment for pressing the fire button without looking long enough, without checking, without double-checking. Karim's son had just graduated high school. Karim's brother was not a militant or even a militant sympathizer, but a school teacher with a master's degree in English literature. For 8 years, he'd been teaching children in the small village school with whatever meager resources he could muster. He left behind a young wife, now a widow, so distraught she could not speak for weeks after the attack, and a 2-year-old boy who would never remember his father. He also left behind hundreds of students with scant chance of resuming their education, young people now mired in hatred for the drone that killed their teacher and aching for revenge." I think the aching for revenge part is very important to realize, because that's what happens when we use these hellfire missiles and kill people, is that more people then become enemies of the United States. And here are just some images again that we don't see on our TV screens. Young people who've been killed by the drones, children who've been left orphaned by the drones. Many times the drones just vaporate their victims, vaporize them, so you don't see any remains. But once again, for various reasons, our newspapers and our TVs don't give us these images. This is an example, when I talked about those pilots who are 8,000 miles away, not knowing what's going on and looking for suspicious behavior. This is an example of a gathering of elders and community leaders called a jirga, which happens regularly in Pakistan. And to some pilot very far away, it must have looked like a bunch of militants coming together to plot some kind of nefarious deed. Instead, it was just a meeting of community leaders. And when the drones struck here, over 50 of them were killed, many of them the most trusted and respected leaders of the community. So again, you could think of what kind of desire for revenge was left after this drone killing. I want to focus for a minute on the story of Tariq Aziz, a 16-year-old who could have picked up a gun like many others did after his cousin was killed in a drone strike. But he was given an opportunity to do something different, and that was to travel to Islamabad for a meeting of drone victim families who, for the first time, would be able to talk to lawyers from both Pakistan and the United Kingdom. And one of the things they realized is that the citizens in that area had to become the journalists themselves. And so they trained people like Tariq Aziz in videography, gave him a camera, and instructed them to go home and witness and provide footage of what happened when the drone strikes. And so this young man was very anxious to go back to his village and do that, because he said that the drones didn't just appear now and then. The drones were constantly in his village, buzzing overhead. But little did he or anybody in that gathering think that the first documentation after that gathering would be the death of Tariq Aziz himself, who was killed 2 days later, and this was all that was left of his body. So what do the Pakistanis themselves have to say about this drone program? Well, we know from some of the WikiLeaks documents that at first the government said to the United States, okay, you go do that drone program and we'll pretend that it's not happening, or we'll say it's our own military that's doing this. But that didn't seem to work very well, because the government realized that this program was actually counterproductive, that it was not only turning people against the United States, but was turning people against the Pakistani government itself and radicalizing the population. And so the Pakistani government went to the U.S. and said, please stop these drone strikes. And the U.S. said no. They voted on it within the legislature 3 times, unanimously saying, now we demand that the U.S. stop the drone strikes. And even then, the U.S. has not listened. It's sad that the United States government says that it goes around the world promoting democracy, but then when democratically elected leaders vote unanimously to say stop the drone strikes, the U.S. doesn't listen. And not only that, it's actually worse, because in this program that is so counterproductive, the Obama administration has just given permission to the military and the CIA to be doing the exact same thing in Yemen. Now, when I say the exact same thing, it means that not only do they have permission to kill individuals that are on a kill list that they know by name and they're going after, but they also have permission to do what's called signature strikes. That's the strikes based not on anybody's verified identity, but just based on suspicious behavior. So in the case of Yemen, these drone strikes have just recently been increased tremendously, and we see the same kind of results that we see in the case of Pakistan. In fact, the very first drone strike under the Obama administration in Yemen was a mistake as well. In fact, a very terrible mistake that killed 14 women and 21 children. And out of the dozens killed, only one person could be identified as having any kind of strong links with Al-Qaeda. In 2009, when the Obama administration started the drone strikes in Yemen, there were maybe 200 members of a group called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They controlled no territory. If you look at it today, there's over 1,000 members of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they control significant territory. There was a very good piece that came out last week in the New York Times. It was called How Drones Help Al-Qaeda, and it was written by a young person in Yemen who said that these drones cause people to join radical militants, not driven by any kind of ideology, but by revenge and despair. And here I quote him saying, the short-term gains from killing military leaders is minuscule compared to the long-term damage the drone program is causing. The U.S. is not only killing people from Yemen, but also killing American citizens in Yemen. You might have heard of the case of Anwar al-Awlaki. Anybody here hear of that case? So he was an American cleric who moved to Yemen, was known for his fiery sermons. He was targeted, put on the kill list by the Obama administration, and was killed in a drone strike along with another American named Samir Khan. Now, the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights have sued the government and demanded the information that was used to put him on the kill list, because they said, you can't kill somebody based on their ideology. We want the evidence that you had to prove that he was actually involved in militant activity that was aimed at the United States. And the Obama administration says it has that information, but refuses to release it. But it's even worse than that, because not only did they kill two adult U.S. citizens, but they also killed the son of Anwar al-Awlaki in a separate drone strike just weeks later, a 16-year-old born in Denver. The pictures that you see are from his Facebook, and according to people who knew him in Denver, he was just a regular American teenager. He said on his Facebook that he liked rap and he liked hip-hop and he liked swimming. He was not involved in any kind of militant activity whatsoever. I found it quite extraordinary that after this killing, there was so little outcry in the United States about the U.S. government killing a 16-year-old American. There were some people in the law community who did push the administration on this. And the first time that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, talked about the drone program at all was only in March of this year, when he was addressing a group of Northwestern law students. And he tried to justify the whole program, saying that it was in consonance with international law because international law allows for the right of self-defense. However, the right of self-defense is very narrowly defined. It means that you have to be, the attack has to be imminent. There has to be no other way to get the people who are about to attack you. You have to have tried to capture these people. And when you talk about imminent, it's like an army amassing at your border or a bomb that is about to be launched at you. It's not that there might be someone sometime who might want to attack you. Well, the U.S. government has also said that they are justified according to U.S. law because in the haste post 9/11, the Congress passed a piece of legislation that gave the Bush administration the green light to use military force. You might remember that there was only one Congresswoman at that time out of all of Congress who said no to that, and that was Barbara Lee. Very good. So that is still being used as a justification, but think about it, because it actually said in that legislation that it was to go after people who were involved in the attack on 9/11. Well, first of all, a lot of the people we are killing right now were maybe 10 or 11 years old at the time of 9/11. Targeting, like the group in Yemen, didn't even exist at the time of 9/11. So I would say, and do say in the chapter I have here on the legality of the drone strikes, that this is against international law and it's against U.S. law. But what about the killing of Americans with drones overseas? I mean, didn't you think that Americans, by the Constitution, have the right to some kind of judicial process? I see a lot of heads shaking yes. Well, I think that most Americans thought that was the case until the Attorney General told these law students that that's not the case, that it turns out that American citizens are not guaranteed judicial process, but they are only guaranteed something vaguely called due process. And it seems like this can be done on Terror Tuesdays in the White House by the president and some of his advisors. Well, the best response to Eric Holder didn't come from the international or the constitutional lawyers of this country. It came from a late night comedian named Stephen Colbert. And I just want to read you what Stephen Colbert said. He said, yes, the founders weren't picky. Trial by jury, trial by fire, rock, paper, scissors, who cares? Due process just means there is a process that you do. And in this case, the president meets with his advisors, decides who to kill, and then kills them. If we are going to win the never-ending war against terror, says Colbert, then there are bound to be casualties, and one of them just happens to be the U.S. Constitution. So let's give a hand to Colbert for being the truth-teller of our times. So this might all work, in quotes, for the U.S. government if the U.S. were the only country that had drones. But this is not the case. It's not like nuclear technology that is so complicated. It's actually a simple technology that can be replicated and can also be bought on the open market. So the U.S. right now, even though we manufacture very little in this country anymore, we still manufacture a lot of weapons, and we are the number one manufacturer of drones. In fact, in Southern California is the hub of a lot of the drone manufacturing. But number two in production as well as in use is Israel. Israel and the United States have long had a collaboration on drones. In fact, the drones that are the lethal ones came from an engineer who worked in the Israeli military and moved to the United States to start a company that would then sell these to the Pentagon. The Israelis have used the drones during the invasion of Gaza in 2008-2009, when of the 1,400 people who were killed, over 800 of them were killed with drones. And drones are continually used in Gaza by the Israeli military. In fact, it's used as a selling point by the military when it tries to sell these drones overseas to say, this has been battle-tested time and time again. Of course, the guinea pigs are the Palestinian people. So the Israelis are number one when it comes to the sale of drones overseas. They sell 85% of the drones to 50 different countries. Now, they say these are surveillance drones, but so were the lethal drones surveillance drones until somebody strapped some weapons onto them. They can be easily converted from surveillance to weaponized drones. The number three producer is China. China recognizes a growth market when it sees one and is now producing dozens of different kinds of drones. So what do you think other countries who now have these drones are thinking? Why shouldn't China say, we have been fighting those Tibetan terrorists for so long, now we're going to go to the United States where some of them are living and just drop a Hellfire missile and kill them? Or why shouldn't the Russians kill the Chechens who are living overseas? Or why shouldn't the Cubans say, those known terrorists who've been living in Miami for so long, we ought to send in a missile there and drop it on their condominium. And if we kill a couple of neighbors in the process, well, you know, oops, that's what happens. Or the Iranians, who downed one of the U.S. spy drones. They said they hacked into the system, and they showed it for all the world to see, to say, look at this beautiful spy drone that we now have. Thank you very much, President Obama, for this gift. And lo and behold, a couple of months later, they reverse engineered it and now have this very sophisticated spy drone. Why shouldn't they be using it to spy over the United States? Well, we know the answer to those questions, and that's until now, because the U.S. is so powerful, other countries don't dare to do it. But how long is that going to last? As I say in the book, what goes around comes around. And it's not just what might come back at us from drones that other countries or other groups might be dropping on people in the United States. There is the issue of drones in the United States by our own government. So let's talk for a minute about drones here in the U.S., because it's really fascinating. Raise your hand if you think there's already a lot of drones being used in the United States. Raise your hand if you don't think there's a lot of drones being used. Okay, the latter group was correct. And that is because the regulation of our airspace is being done by the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, and their mandate is to keep our airspace safe. Well, they know something that the general public doesn't know, and that is these drones crash all the time. In fact, the Air Force has admitted that a third of the drones crash, and the CIA doesn't admit anything, so we don't know how many of their drones crash, but we can assume that it's a lot. And we even know that the very big drone, I mentioned the Global Hawk, the size of a commercial airplane, crashed just about a couple of weeks ago in Maryland, and luckily it crashed in a swamp. but it could have easily crashed above a residential area and killed a lot of people. So the FAA has been reluctant to give out a lot of permits, but it's also been reluctant to tell us how many permits it's been giving out. And it took the group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation to sue the FAA to start getting some of this information out. Some of the permits, and there are only about 300 permits right now that agencies in the U.S. have. Some of them are government agencies like the FBI, Homeland Security, the Border Patrol is using them on the southern and the northern borders. Some of them are companies that are testing out the drones. Some of them are universities, state universities, that are working with the military on this drone program. And a handful of them are police departments. Well, the drone manufacturers have a problem with the slow pace that the permits are being given out with in the United States. And so what do? They form their own lobby. And of course, what does a very good lobby in the United States do? It buys congresspeople. And so they have done what the American way is. They've bought their congresspeople, and they now have their own drone caucus in Congress, made up of 58 members of Congress, mostly Republicans, but Democrats are in there too, including some self-described liberal Democrats. And they, according to their mandate, they are addressing the urgent need to have more drones being used overseas and at home, both for commercial and law enforcement purposes. And so together with the drone industry and the drone caucus, they wrote a new piece of legislation that was signed by President Obama. In fact, on Valentine's Day of this year, a great big Valentine's present for the drone industry. And it says the FAA must open up the U.S. airspace totally to drones by the end of September 2015, and for law enforcement before that. Well, I mentioned that there are some police departments that are experimenting with drones. The drone lobby would like to see every police department, and there's about 18,000 of them, would like to see everyone have their own fleet of drones. Well, the problem is not only the permit so far, but the problem is also money, because police departments, like every other department in most places, are broke. They're cutting pensions, they're cutting salaries, and so where are they going to get money to buy drones? The federal government, that's right. And so here comes Homeland Security to the rescue, and the Justice Department as well, to say, we will give you grants to experiment with these drones. So it's like a drug pusher coming and say, you know, here, little girl, wouldn't you like to try this? Getting them hooked on drones and getting the other police departments around them to say, hey, you know, we want drones as well. So I talk a little bit in the book about this new phenomena of drones coming home. And I wanted to quote the CEO of a company that sold drones to a police department right outside of Houston. And he said at a press conference that these drones were designed for the police departments to use for surveillance purposes, but they actually were also designed to be weaponized. And they could in the future be outfitted with what we call less lethal systems, like tasers that can electrocute suspects on the ground, beanbag firing guns called stun batons. They can also have hand grenades. They can also have 12-gauge shotguns. They said, rest assured, said the sheriff in this press conference. He said, no matter what we do in law enforcement, somebody's going to question it. But we're going to do the right thing, and I can assure you of that. So I don't know. Are you feeling reassured? So either is the ACLU and other civil libertarians who are saying that everything is in place right now for a 24/7 surveillance society, and that if our police departments indeed get their hands on drones, they can use them to spy on Muslim community, black community, who else might they want to spy on? Code Pink, the peace community, environmental activists, you name it. We already know that many of these groups have been infiltrated by the FBI, so why shouldn't they be spied on by drones? It's very interesting, though, because This threat of drones coming home to spy on it is something that has sparked a real response in the United States. And so we gathered together a couple of hundred people in Washington, D.C. at the end of April to talk about what can we do about this. So first, in terms of things that we can do overseas, we talked about a campaign that would step up the kind of visible protests in front of Air Force bases around this country. And we've identified many dozens of Air Force bases and are trying to get communities like the Code Pink groups, Catholic worker groups, and people who were so active during the Bush administration to protest in front of the military bases, protest at the sites of the drone manufacturers, and other offices that are involved in the production and the use of drones. We were also told by some of the lawyers at the drone conference that one of the best things to do would be to focus on the CIA's drones, because that is so patently illegal that there can be justification to say that the military should have drones as part of its arsenal, and yes, they should be regulated, but why should the CIA have drones? The CIA is not a military organization, it's a civilian organization, and according to international law, when a civilian organization like the CIA is engaged in militant activity, they should be considered unlawful combatants. You've heard that term used about the Taliban. Well, that's what international law says about the CIA as of drones. And the other thing about the CIA is that it has no accountability. I mean, they can kill wherever and whenever they want, and there is nothing in place to get the wheels turning to find out what happened. And so we have been focusing on Dianne Feinstein as the senator in California, who is the head on the Senate of the Intelligence Committee. And we're going to pass around a sign-up sheet now. We will be taking these to her office. We went and met with her office last week in California, and now we're going to meet with her in Washington, D.C. So please sign on to this so that we can show that there are thousands of her constituents that are feeling that Dianne Feinstein is not doing her job, that she should make sure that our government is respecting international law, and part of what she can do is take drones out of the hands of the CIA. Another thing that we want to do is to take a peace delegation to Pakistan. And for the first time, this would be people coming from the United States to work together with groups and individuals in Pakistan to try to do a march to the areas in northern Pakistan where the drone strikes are killing so many innocent people. We will indeed do this at the first week of October, the 2nd through 10th of October. We don't know if the Pakistani government will allow us to go to that region, but if we can't get there, we will be bringing lots of people from northern Pakistan into the capital, Islamabad, to meet with us and to tell their stories so we can come back to the United States with more firsthand information about why these drone strikes are so dangerous. If you are interested in that delegation, perhaps you can come see me or my colleague Tig Barry right here at the table afterwards, and we can tell you more about it. There's also a place on the sign-up sheet where you can check if you're interested in that. There is also underway an effort to regulate drones on the international level. You might have heard how campaigns have done that in the case of landmines, cluster bombs, and other weapons. And there's a group made up mostly of scientists that's working with the United Nations to try to come up with some way to regulate the use of drones. And it's very interesting that just last week, for the first time, the UN has taken up the issue of drones at the Human Rights Council, and that the head of the Human Rights Council has asked the United States to justify its use of drones according to international law, has issued a 28-page report that calls on the United States to say why it is not capturing these suspects instead of killing them, and it called for not only accountability and justice, but for reparation for the victims of the drones and their families. So that is quite an important development at the United Nations. And in terms of drones here at home, well, I talked about how these police departments are wanting drones. So there's one simple thing that we're going to be asking you to do, and that is call your police department. We're going to pass around a piece of paper now that has just three simple questions on it. And if you can make that one phone call, that really could be a difference between your police department getting drones or not getting drones. So I hope that you'll take that action. The other is to try to get cities throughout this country to say that they want to be drone-free zones, passing resolutions at the local level. And we talked to some of the organizers, including the local Code Pink, about trying to spearhead that here in this area. Let's give a hand to those wonderful women. And so, Charlotte, can we say that this will be something that Code Pink will be looking into here? Wonderful. And if there's anybody that wants to work with you on that, how can they get involved?
Call the Peace and Justice Center.
Terrific. And if you want to look at more depth at any of these issues, we have them on a new site called droneswatch.org. So I want to end just by invoking a question that a friend of ours asked. And he is a Pakistani lawyer that we have been working with on this issue of the drone victim. Made a lot of money and started hearing more about drone victims, and went and started talking to some of these victims' families. And the more he learned, the more horrified he became. He stopped doing his corporate practice, and he started to work for free to represent drone victims. It's funny because he used to work also with the United States, the U.S. Agency for International Development. He also worked with the FBI on terrorism cases. We used to come to the United States on an expedited visa until he started working with the drone victims. Then he no longer was so welcome here in the United States. In fact, he sued the head of the CIA in Pakistan for murder. And of course, that wasn't seen too kindly by the U.S. government. But he said, had this question that he posed. He said, "Can you trust a program that has been in existence for 8 years, that picks its targets in secret, that faces zero accountability and has killed almost 3,000 people in Pakistan alone, whose identities are not known to their killers? When women and children in Waziristan are killed with Hellfire missiles, Pakistanis believe this is what the American people want. I would like to ask Americans, do you?" So this is a question I think that we have to answer with a resounding no. We do not want to kill women. We do not want to kill children. We do not want to kill anybody. We are tired of war, tired of the killing. It's been over 10 years now. And a program that is so counterproductive, a program that is creating more enemies faster than we can kill them, a program that violates international law, violates domestic law, violates our Constitution, and violates the sanctity of human life, we have to answer with a resounding no. So let's remember that while right now the American people might still think that this is a program that, according to U.S. counterintelligence chief in the United States, John Brennan, he said it is a program that is ethical, just, wise, and surgically precise, that our government is lying to us, that we have to educate people to turn those numbers around, that in a recent poll that came out that looked at 22 different countries and asked people, what do you think of the drone strikes? The only ones that said they were okay was the United States, people in England, and unfortunately people in India, who I guess thought it was okay to kill Pakistanis. But for the rest of the world, they thought it was absolutely terrible. So we should, on the one hand, perhaps feel empowered to know that the majority of the people around the world have more information that we than we have and understand how dangerous this drone program is. So our job now is to take the majority of American people and have them join the world public opinion to say, stop the killer drones, stop the drone program, end the killing now. Thank you so much. I think that there's a lot of truth to be said that this is the military-industrial, and you know, it's the military-industrial congressional complex, and it all feeds into each other, and yes, they want to keep the American people in a state of fear and want to keep selling these war machines, and war is in their interest. But I think that there's some other elements involved as well, and certainly some of these drone attacks are indeed mistakes. And an element in that is that we have not created the countervailing force to the military-industrial complex. We have not created a movement that's independent of partisan politics. When George Bush was in power, we had hundreds of thousands of people who had come out on the streets to protest. When George Bush was in power, there was an outcry around Guantanamo, around indefinite detention, extraordinary rendition. In fact, you in this area have been very involved in exposing how a local company was involved in flying people to places where they would be tortured. And this outcry, unfortunately, became very muted once President Obama came into power for several reasons, but one is partisan politics. People wanted to give Obama some time. They liked him. Then it became, as we got closer to these elections now, well, you don't want to speak out against a Democrat. And of course, there were other issues like the financial crisis, and people became much more focused inwardly. But I would venture to say that if George Bush were in power and this kind of incredibly destructive drone program were going on under the Bush administration, we would have hundreds of thousands of people out in the street again saying no. So we can say that there's this industrial military complex that always feeds on war, but I think we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, why is it that we're not able to build up a stronger movement that is independent of party politics and that forces whoever is in power to have the kind of foreign policy that we the people not only want, but we need in order to be safe at home and in order to be putting our resources into rebuilding this country and not creating more enemies overseas.
Now, we conclude with most of a speech by Glenn Greenwald, whom we featured earlier in the show. This is from December the 8th, 2012. He was speaking at a conference entitled "An Injury to One is an Injury to All," a conference in defense of civil liberties to end indefinite detention.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming out this afternoon, and thank you as well to the conference organizers for inviting me here to speak. I speak at a lot of events, and it's actually truly inspiring to be at an event organized by a group that was born out of a desire not merely to voice grievances, but to organize against them. We need a lot more of that, and it's really great to be part of an event that is dedicated to that goal. And it's also really great to be part of an event that is grounded in the recognition of how important it is to build coalitions based on the premise that every group in the United States that is engaged in activism against the government, to check the government, and that especially is vulnerable to majoritarian oppression, has an equal stake in civil liberties and civil rights, and is equally affected when any one group has their rights abridged. That is a crucial precept for understanding the danger of the civil liberties assault in the United States. Now, I write a lot about civil liberties. I speak a lot about civil liberties. The title of the conference that we're here to convene for is a civil liberties conference. And so there's a lot of different ways to talk about this term civil liberties. It's a pretty complex area. There's a lot of different approaches one can take. But one of the things that I think is so crucial to do whenever I write about civil liberties or talk about civil liberties in an event like this is to take a few minutes and ask the question, what is it that we even mean by the term civil liberties? What is it that that denotes? And the reason I think that's so important is because it's a term that gets tossed around a lot. You hear politicians of all stripes all the time invoking this concept. It's pretty much a cliche at this point. Nobody debates civil liberties. No one ever stands up and says, I just want you to know that my position on civil liberties is that I'm against it. It's something that it's just a slogan designed to justify whatever anyone wants to justify. And so it's important to really understand the definition of what this term is. And the good thing about that endeavor, about understanding what the term civil liberties actually is that it is not a very complicated concept. It's actually fairly straightforward. When we describe civil liberties or talk about defending our core liberties or our constitutional rights, all we really are referring to is the list of prohibitions, the list of limitations that we have imposed on the government regarding how they can exercise their power against us. It is a list that we've imposed on them and said, you can never cross these lines if we're to accept the assertion of your authority as legitimate and valid. And the good thing, the further good thing about that endeavor, about understanding what the term civil liberties means, is that we don't have to go out on a sort of scavenger hunt in search of this list of limitations that we've imposed on the government's power. That list is found, it has been assembled all in one place, which is called the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And the best thing about this endeavor, about understanding what civil liberties means, is that this list of prohibitions, the limitations that we've imposed on the state, are not ambiguous or muddled, nor are they circumstantial or conditional. They don't apply only in times of peace or whenever it can't be demonstrated that national security would be aided by their violation. They are clear and absolute and unconditional. And the way that you know that is simply by looking at the list and seeing what it says. So if you look at the First Amendment, it says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. If you look at the Fourth Amendment, it says, nobody shall be subjected to unreasonable searches and seizures without a probable cause warrant, a warrant issued upon a finding of probable cause. If you look at the Fifth Amendment, it says, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They are absolute in their expressions. They're unconditional in their application. I once had this fairly acrimonious exchange with Joe Klein of Time Magazine. I've actually had many acrimonious exchanges with Joe Klein of Time Magazine, but this one in particular that I'm thinking of took place in 2008 or 2009, and it was an argument about civil liberties. I don't recall the specifics, but it went on for a couple of weeks, and it became very kind of confrontational, and it involved the exchange of lots of accusatory statements. And in the middle of it, he wrote something and said, I think what's driving all of this, the key thing to realize about why this dispute has arisen is that Glenn Greenwald is a civil liberties extremist. And honestly, what happened was when I read that statement by him, I was actually really bewildered because I thought to myself, you know, I don't understand this. We're having this extremely vituperative exchange. We're saying all sorts of horrible things about each other. And all of a sudden in the middle, he just stopped and decided to lavish this incredible praise on me. Like, I'm a civil liberties extremist. And it took me a few minutes. And then I realized, oh, wait, actually, no. When he says that, he actually means that that's like a bad thing. And the reason that was so confusing to me was because civil liberties extremist is, in essence, the greatest compliment that someone can pay you. And the reason I say that is because there is no way to defend liberties without being extreme about it. There is no way to express fealty to these rights that I just described without insisting upon their application to everyone equally and in all circumstances. The minute you start justifying pragmatic waivers of them or exceptions to be made for pragmatic considerations is the minute that you cease to believe in them. And what I think is so critical about this concept of civil liberties and the specific expressions of it that it finds in our Bill of Rights, in our Constitution, is that if you look at the state of the United States, and you've heard about this all day, including from Professor Aziz just now, what you find are not isolated case-by-case violations of them. What you find are fundamental and systematic repudiations of these rights. So if you look at the history over the last decade of the way in which American Muslims have been prosecuted for, quote, material support for terrorism, what you find is that they've been targeted and prosecuted based not on acts that they've undertaken, but on beliefs that they've expressed. If you look at the sprawling surveillance state that has been erected, in which all of our activities are monitored and recorded and stored in government databases without any indication that we've done anything wrong, let alone a showing of probable cause that we have, it is as complete and pure a violation of the Fourth Amendment as it gets. And if you look at the system of indefinite detention, of putting people in cages, often for life, without even a pretense of any charge, or what we have now, which is targeting people, including American citizens, for execution, for extrajudicial assassination, in total secrecy, without charges, oversight of any kind, that is as profound and complete a repudiation of the Fifth Amendment's guarantee against the deprivation of life or liberty without due process of law. This is a systematic violation of these liberties, not isolated case-by-case basis. And what's most striking about it to me is that as we move further away from the precipitating pretext, which is the attack of 9/11, what one finds is that these violations become more acute. They continue to increase rather than recede. And so what I want to do is just spend a few minutes asking two questions about this state of affairs. One of which is, why has this happened? Why has it been allowed to happen with relatively little backlash and resistance of the type that we've convened here today to generate? And secondly, what are the primary implications of allowing these sorts of abuses to continue in such a fundamental way for as long as we've allowed them to continue? And the reason I think those two questions are so crucial is because only by understanding what causes it and understanding why it's so crucial to stop it, can we ourselves begin to think about how to create strategies for arresting it and convincing our fellow citizens to join us in that effort. So let me begin with that first question, which is, why has this all happened? Why have we allowed this to happen? And I think there are a few reasons why this has taken place and why it's been so difficult to combat it. What are the impediments? The first of which is that all of this is taking place in the context of war. And not just a war against a specific country, but a war against multiple countries on the planet. The reason that's so significant is because it is always the case, historically in every society it is the case, that in times of war, that is when the power of political leaders is most unconstrained. 2,000 years ago, Cicero said, "When men pick up arms, the law falls mute." There are no limits, or very few limits, that can be effectively applied to political leaders when they're prosecuting and waging a war. That was why it was supposed to be so difficult under the Constitution for wars to be commenced, because of the threat that they pose to our core liberties. And what's most amazing about the quote-unquote war which we're currently fighting is that, unlike prior wars in American history that have justified civil liberties abuses, which ended when those wars ended, so Abraham Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus ended when the Civil War did. Franklin Roosevelt's internment of Japanese Americans, they were liberated once World War II was over. This war, by design, can have no end. It is designed to be an internal and permanent war. Just 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that the Obama administration is in the process of codifying its quote-unquote kill lists by creating what the administration is calling a disposition matrix. A matrix that analyzes algorithms to determine how you should be disposed of. Should you be put into prison indefinitely without charges? Should you be killed? Should you be charged with a crime? And the premise of this system, said the Washington Post, was that Obama administration officials are acting on the premise that the quote-unquote war on terror will take place for at least another decade, which means that it will have lasted longer than 20 years. And when you talk about a war that lasts for 20 years, you're no longer talking about a finite, discrete event that ushers in civil liberties abridgments that end when the wars do. You're talking about a fundamental and radical transformation of the kind of government we have. The other aspect of war that makes it so difficult to combat civil liberties abridgments is that one of the crucial strategies of war on the part of every government is to dehumanize the group against whom violence is being applied. And the reason that's so crucial is because no population, other than the most sociopathic, would tolerate years and years and years of continuous lethal force applied to a foreign population unless the humanity of that population has been obscured and hidden and denied, unless they've become dehumanized. And this war has involved the lethal application of force against almost exclusively one group of people, which are Muslims. And although the government and its officials will explicitly say that we're not at war against Muslims generally or against Islam, the theory, which is that every time the U.S. government imprisons somebody without charges or kills somebody, that it should be assumed, without evidence being presented, without due process being afforded, that those people somehow deserve it, that they're militants or terrorists or whatever other labels the government and the media slap upon them reflexively. The theory has created the idea in the minds of the population by design that this group of people, American Muslims, or Muslims generally, are collectively guilty, that they're really not human in the way that we would object if any other group of human beings were being treated in this manner. And this dual approach of war, heightening the power of political leaders at the same time dehumanizing the group which is targeted, makes it very difficult to combat rights abridgments because of the idea that anything the government does in its name is probably justified. The second reason why this is so difficult to combat and why this has been allowed to happen is related to the first. Professor Aziz talked a lot about this. Other speakers today have as well. So I'm just going to touch upon it. It is the idea that because these abuses are only happening to one small marginalized group of people, that there really is no reason for most other people to be concerned about it, that you can be indifferent to it or even supportive of it. And I think, you know, it's easy to mock that idea. It's easy to condemn other people for thinking that because these rights abuses aren't affecting them, that they can somehow forget about it or be even supportive of it. But I think it's important to recognize just how potent of a strategy that is, how it can affect all of us, including people who are otherwise sympathetic to these issues. So I know lots of people who will read the things I write, who read about these injustices, who will say, look, I agree with you, these things are horrible. But deep in their minds, they know that when they wake up tomorrow morning, because they're not Muslim, because they're white, that it is extremely unlikely that they're going to be abducted and taken to Guantanamo or put in a cage without charges. They know it's extremely unlikely that a drone will be sent over their house with a cruise missile launch that blows up their house and their children. So it's very easy to deprioritize these issues, even if we think they're injustices, and to believe that they don't really require as much urgency as others that might affect us more directly. And aside from the obvious moral reason that I think nobody in this room needs to know, the sign, the motto of the conference is, an injury to one is an injury to all. Aside from that moral precept, which is incredibly compelling, it is the case that it is just incredibly misguided to think in that way from a practical or pragmatic standpoint, because it is always the case, not sometimes, not usually, but always the case, that civil liberties abridgments, abuses of core rights, extend beyond their original application to all sorts of unanticipated groups. And you can look at the history of the Patriot Act over the last 10 years, which has been applied overwhelmingly in 85% of the cases to matters having nothing to do with terrorism. Or you look at the FBI strategy of creating their own plots and financing their own plots and luring people into their own plots and then at the last minute heroically breaking up their own plots and then announcing to the world how grateful we should be that they've kept us safe and yet again broken up their own plot. That tactic is now being applied to anarchist activists, to people protesting NATO policies, to, as Professor Aziz said, to the Occupy movement. And what we see most of all, and I think most perniciously of all, is the importation of war on terror tactics from what was once confined to foreign soil into domestic soil. So if you listen to U.S. national security officials who 10 years ago and 8 years ago and even 5 years ago were saying that the greatest threat to American national security was Al-Qaeda, what they now say is that the greatest threat to national security are what they call, quote, homegrown terrorists. And so you see the civil liberties abuses of the last several years being directed not outward to foreign nationals, but inward domestically to American citizens. That's what the dilution of Miranda rights are about for people taken in on and arrested on U.S. soil. It's what the NDAA is designed to do, which is to codify the power of indefinite detention on U.S. soil. It's what the paramilitarization of our local and state police forces, based on tactics perfected in Baghdad, is designed to do. It's what the increasingly rapid importation of drones is all about. Drones are coming to the United States. They are already in use for surveillance capabilities in numerous American cities by numerous local police departments. It is inevitable that they will spread not just for surveillance, but also for weaponized purposes. You see this importation of what was once something we could convince ourselves was confined to foreign soil, increasingly into domestic soil, and finding ways to convince our fellow citizens that we all have an equal stake in combating these abridgments is, in my view, of the highest priority in terms of combating them. Earlier, there was a speaker who was an official with the Electric Union, John Woodruff, who spoke, and I wish everyone could hear what he said, not just in this room, but everywhere, because he talked about how civil liberties abridgments are a core issue for the labor movement. And the reason that he gave was that any organization that wants to agitate against those in power has an equal stake in protecting these liberties, is equally endangered when they're assaulted. That's true not just of the labor movement, but of every single political activist group that is trying to accomplish change in the United States. That is what civil liberties is about. It's why an abridgment for one person is abridgment for everyone. The third reason that I think it's so difficult to combat these things and has been so hard, and the reason why we've been allowing it to happen, is because of the role that partisan allegiance plays in all of this. Professor Aziz talked about the fear-mongering campaign that has been incredibly effective, but so too is the role that partisan loyalty has. There's this incredible report, which you can find online, which I would urge you to go read. It's a 2008 report that was prepared by the CIA at the height of the general election between John McCain and Barack Obama. And what prompted the CIA report that was written in secret and ultimately leaked to WikiLeaks, which published it, was the concern that anti-war sentiment was spreading in Western Europe. And it had actually caused the fall of two Western European governments that were supportive of the war in Afghanistan. And the CIA was petrified that if this anti-war sentiment continued to spread, it would compel the withdrawal of troops from every government in Western Europe, and ultimately it would spread to the United States. And what this report concluded was that the only real weapon against the spreading anti-war sentiment, the only tool that could really be a good, effective antidote, would be the election of Barack Obama. And the reason, said the CIA report, why that would happen was because if Obama was elected, it would replace, as the face of American wars, this swaggering evangelical cowboy that the world had come to hate, and replace it with a much softer, more sophisticated, educated, urbane, progressive, constitutional lawyer that would then transform huge numbers of war opponents into people who view these wars as humanitarian. And that CIA report was incredibly prescient, not just in terms of being able to sustain support for American militarism, but also to ensure that even greater amounts of support for this rights assault was prevalent in the United States. And I know this from my own experience. I've been speaking about civil liberties now in the United States for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And if I spoke 4 or 5 years ago to a room like this and you just assembled 100 people randomly from the street and I stood up and I denounced all the policies that I've just denounced and I talked about the civil liberties issues I've just spoken about, you would have half of that room of randomly assembled Americans 4 years ago extremely antagonistic to what I was saying, completely hating me. Those were called Republicans. Because they were very supportive of these policies because they were George Bush and Dick Cheney's policies, but you would have 50% of the room thinking exactly the opposite way. They'd be boisterously cheering me, saying that I was defending everything that was sacred and about America, I was defending American values, fighting against right-wing radicalism. Those were called Democrats. So you had this incredibly divisive citizenry surrounding these issues. 4 years later, if you assemble that same audience and I stand up and I speak about the same exact policies in the same exact way, you'll have 85% of that room hating me 80% if I'm lucky, and 15 to 20% of the room being supportive because huge numbers of Democrats have now become supportive of the very policies that 4 years ago they were denouncing as right-wing radicalism because it's now a Democratic president.
And if you'd like to hear the remaining 10 minutes of that speech, it's available for download from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/661. All previous episodes are available from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.